What are some of the most important turning points in the history of our world? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Brant Berglund, your host and study guide author, and we're continuing, we're just about in the middle of a 13-week series entitled Three Cosmic Messages, dealing with the three angels' messages in Revelation 14. I'm delighted to have as my conversation partners throughout this quarter Dr. Doug Thompson, Professor of Mechanical Engineering, and Dr. Janice McKenzie, Professor of Bioengineering, both colleagues of mine here at Walla Walla University. And when you think about the world history, right? I mean, just recorded history, you know, 6,000 or 7,000 years, the way people talk sometimes. When you think about the world, what are some of the turning points or momentous occasions in the history of our world that you can think of? Just a couple, maybe? Do you have one?
Well, I can think of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, right? Everything changed then. And of course, Jesus, his life and death changed everything.
What right. comes to my mind is the Spanish Armada, but, you know, it's always
Say more. What do you mean?
There's this, the story, the Spain was, of course, the big colonial power, and they had all these ships, but those ships were made by the British. And the British, of course, then had all the technology, and they had even a better fleet. And so there was more ships from Spain, and Spain was the big, you know, the 200-pound strong guy, and Britain was looked at as the weakling on the beach. But when they actually then had the big fight, and the British won, and that was the end of Spanish dominance.
A shocking Goliath, David and Goliath sort of story. Yeah, so obviously the Tree of the Knowledge of Good and Evil set into motion a series of events into which we are captured today. And the Spanish Armada never would have happened if it hadn't been for the Tree of the Knowledge of Good and Evil. The story of Jesus, transformational for millions, even billions of people on our planet, right? And I think about some recent event, more recent, the development of atomic weaponry that has changed the face of international politics. The microchip and, yeah, the technology that we have there, the space race, different sorts of events. And there is a turning point in the history of our faith. We come from a Seventh-day Adventist tradition, which says that something important happened in the mid-1800s, and it is related to our story in Revelation of these three angels. It says the hour of God's judgment has come, and there is a link in Revelation 14 with the hour of God's judgment back to the introductory verse to our whole section, which is chapter 11, verse 19, that mentions the Ark of the Covenant being seen. And that's Day of Atonement language. Our lesson this week, the quarterly that we study, takes us all the way back to the book of Daniel, the Old Testament apocalyptic. We might say parallel to Revelation, and it specifically chapters 8 and 9. But it seems that we need to start with chapter 2 briefly. In chapter 2, King Nebuchadnezzar has a dream, and he views the nations that would come onto the world stage as an image, and each succeeding piece of metal as part of this image represents a different nation. There's Babylon, there's Medo-Persia, there's Greece, there's Rome. Then Rome gets divided up, and then God establishes a kingdom during the division of the world, with Rome still having a part in it. But chapter 7, Daniel has a parallel dream, and in Daniel's dream, the image is replaced with a number of predatory animals. So while Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, has a dream of the nations as something worthy of worship and idolatry, right? Power was something to be idolized. For Daniel, the beasts represent kingdoms who prey on small little kingdoms like Israel, right? Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome. But then in chapter 7, we have an addition to the story in Daniel 2, and that is that there's a little horn that comes out of this fourth beast, who we would say was Rome. This little horn comes out and begins to speak boastfully. He changes times and laws. He persecutes God's people. And this little horn, which is part of Rome, ends up being almost antichrist in its approach to the world, right? And to God himself. And then Daniel 7 shows a picture of a judgment scene. Books are opened. The one like the Son of Man comes to the Ancient of Days. The court is seated. Books are opened. The little horn is judged, and the kingdom is given to the saints. Okay, overall, big question. Is that a good news judgment or a bad news judgment?
Good news.
Why is it good news? What's so good about it?
Because that little horn is cast down, and he's not able to persecute the people of God anymore. And the saints of God shall reign forever and ever.
That, yeah, that's a good news story, right? So why is it that when we hear about judgment, we're so quick to say, oh, judgment is fearful, judgment is scary? Why are we so quick to say that when I read Daniel 7, man, judgment is given in favor of the saints, right? Well, maybe this is too personal a question, but have you ever had to go to trial for something? I remember when I was young and 16 and got into a car accident and I had to go stand before a judge. For me, that was a difficult day because I knew what I had done was wrong. And I stood before the judge, quaking in my boots. And the judge was stern, yet gracious. And I had to go do some driver's education training, and I had to do a little community service, right? And it was good for me. That judgment was good for me, but it was scary. But what if you had been accused of doing something wrong and it wasn't your fault? Would you want judgment?
Yes.
If it was just. You wouldn't want judgment to falsely accuse you.
Mm.
But if you felt like the judge, going back to our discussion last week, was just, then you would long for that day in court where you could be justified.
Where all the evidence could be laid out on the table, right? Yeah. Everything could be looked at. So Daniel 8 now, if we move to Daniel 8, and I know we're doing a 30,000-foot super fast flyby, but Daniel 8 now presents another dream for Daniel, and this one is near the end of Babylon's reign, and Babylon no longer plays a role in this vision, but Daniel sees a ram with two horns, and then a goat comes and tramples on the ram and breaks its horns, and we're told who these beasts represent. The ram represents the Medes and the Persians. Each horn represents the imbalance of power in the Medo-Persian alliance. And then we have the kingdom of Greece, who is the goat. And a single prominent horn between his eyes, it looks like Alexander the Great. And then at the height of his power, the horn is broken, and it's divided up into four more horns, which seem to represent the four major generals who took over the kingdom of Alexander, Seleucus and Ptolemy and Cassander and Lysimachus, and their kingdom is divided up into four different pieces. Essentially, there's still some city-states in Greece, but these are the main sections. And then it says that out of one of, and they're divided up to the four winds of the compass. And then it says out of one of them comes another little horn. And it's like, wait, does the little horn come up from one of these other four horns? No, the language in Daniel using, when we look at the gendered language, right, it uses masculine and feminine language there. When it says out of one of them, it appears to be one of the four winds, comes this little horn who both tramples then on the Holy Land, and he has this horizontal campaign where he destroys God's people, or he destroys earth, and then he attacks heaven, just like the little horn in Daniel 7. And it appears that this horn that comes out of nowhere represents Rome, both in its pagan and its papal phases. But what's so interesting is that as this little horn is trampling and destroying, and it attacks God and it attacks God's people, it says in Daniel 8 that Daniel asks, and the angel asks, how long is this going to go on? How long are we going to see the trampling of God's people and his sanctuary and the tearing down of his times and his laws? How long will this go on? And an answer is given, unto 2,300 evening morning. And then the sanctuary will be set right or vindicated or cleansed. Help me out. When I hear that term 2300 evening morning, I at first might not know what to do with it. But how have you understood that time prophecy there, the 2300 evening morning? What does it represent?
Well, so we know that a day equals a year. There's a couple of verses that we can use to provide that information.
In Bible prophecy.
In Bible prophecy, yes. Yeah. And so that would be 2,300 years.
Years. Is there any evidence from Daniel 8 that the prophecy is a long-range prophecy, right? Is like, there is there anything that suggests that 2,300 years is even in view here? Well, there's a couple things. Number one, Daniel is told, seal up the dream and the vision, for it pertains to the time of the end. Mm-hmm. And then he's told as well, after he's really sick, after he hears this vision, the angel says, go your way, Daniel. This vision pertains to many days in the future. Like, this is not for the near future, right?
Yeah.
How many years is 2,300 literal days, right? It's like, what, it's just like seven years.
And obviously the Medo-Persian empire, where this started, lasted longer than that by itself.
By itself.
Clearly goes into Greece and so, yeah.
And beyond
really
and into Rome.
300 days.
Right. And this idea of an evening morning, it's like, where does evening morning come from? And this is the interesting piece. An evening morning takes us back to Genesis. The evening and the morning were the first day, but evening and morning were also the times when the sacrifices were offered in Israel. An evening sacrifice and a morning. You already always started with the evening because that's when the new day began. Notice the creatures here, a ram and a goat. How often do we see a ram and a goat together in the Old Testament, especially related to sacrifices? Because the whole chapter here talks about the sacrificial system being torn down, the place of God's sanctuary being torn down. These two animals are seen only on one day in the entire year in Israel, both as sacrificial animals. That's the Day of Atonement. Like, the whole passage is saturated with judgment language. And most people in our faith tradition, Seventh-day Adventism, would look at the 2,300 evening mornings and say, wow, this is a long-range prophecy that's going to extend from John's day, you know, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome. It's going to extend all the way down to the time when God wants to reestablish the sanctuary and cleanse it and start the Day of Atonement work. The challenge that we have, though, is that does that mean that the 2,300 evening morning prophecy begins in Daniel's day? Does it begin after that? We don't really have a good answer for that, right, in Daniel 8. Daniel 9, we don't have time. We have 2 minutes left, right? And we don't have time to go into Daniel 9, but Daniel 9 seems to give us a start date. So as Seventh-day Adventists, how do you feel about 1844 being the date when something important happened? Are you comfortable with that as a point in time where you would say, yeah, I think God is doing something important in history, world event?
I think so. When you look back at the reawakening that happened at that time, and then the fact that there was a group that believed so strongly about this, and even more importantly, once they were disappointed, the way that it drove them to really dig into the scriptures in a more powerful way, I think was an extreme change in the church and the way that the Bible was treated and the prophecy was treated, and awoke us to a lot of things.
Good evidence.
Yes, there were revivals happening all over the United States and the world at that time. And that's big evidence that something unusual happened in 1843 and 1844.
Yeah. Yeah. Our time is up, and I wish we could go into this more, but I encourage you to go study it more on your own. I want to say thank you to Dr. McKenzie and Dr. Thompson for being part of our conversation. Thank you to Samuel Hoffman for being so dedicated in doing the sound and recording and engineering for us. My thanks also to, we haven't mentioned, but Rick Baskett, who helps make these conversations available. My thanks to you also for listening in. For The Good Word, I'm Brant Berglund.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.